This is KCBX Central Coast Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up is a feature of Festival Mosaic, the classical music festival coming to San Luis Obispo this July. KCBX's Marisa Waddell talks to Festival Mosaic music director Scott Yu about his 20th anniversary with the festival.
People do this festival just because they love playing music. And so there's a certain type of energy and freshness that comes out of it that is really hard to replicate.
Then KCBX show host David Figueroa speaks with Festival Mosaic executive producer Lloyd Tanner about Cuban mambo group Orquesta Acocan.
People really loved it, and after that album, we've been touring the world ever since.
These stories coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 14th. I'm Samantha Doyle Jacobson, sitting in for Meher Ali. It's summertime, which means it's music festival time. And one of the biggest music festivals on the Central Coast is Festival Mosaic, which is celebrating its 55th year. The festival's co-founder, Cliff Swanson, was the first music director of what was then called the San Luis Obispo Mozart Festival. Now, Scott Yu is celebrating two decades as the second music director of Festival Mosaic.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Festival Mosaic starts this week. It runs Wednesday, July 16th through Saturday, the 26th, in venues all over San Luis Obispo County, and features great music, film, food, educational events, and lots more. Festival Mosaic mostly features classical music, but presents other genres too, and this year is music director Scott Yu's 20th anniversary with the festival. Scott is here with me now to talk about what we can expect over the next 2 weeks. Welcome, Scott.
Nice to see you, Marisa.
Yeah, good to see you too. You have an international career, traveling around for your, now here, this TV series on PBS, working in Mexico City and more. What is it about Festival Mosaic that keeps you coming back every summer for 20 years?
It's three words: the people, the people, the people. I think that if San Luis Obispo were exactly the same climate, geography, houses, streets, businesses, everything were the same, but I didn't know anybody here, I don't think there would be much of a draw. You know, one of the great things about coming back here is that, especially for an event like A Notable Encounter, when I look out at the audience, when anybody asks a question, usually I can answer them by name. I usually know everybody. There are some new people every year at every event, and then I learn their names. And so there is this kind of one-on-one interaction that I really love. And of course, a lot of the musicians are some of my closest friends. At my wedding, I think 40% of the people that were at my wedding were either people from the community of San Luis Obispo or people who performed at the festival. So I feel very fortunate to have been here for 20 years and very fortunate to know the really fascinating people that I know because of music and this festival. I mean, boy, my life would be infinitely less rich without it. And there would be no Now Hear This TV show without this festival as well. So.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Wow. And you built your family around this festival.
So, you know, our Alice's baby shower was held here in San Luis Obispo.
Hmm.
It was here.
Mm-hmm.
Not in Connecticut, where I'm from, not in Cleveland, where she's from. It was held in San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice place, isn't it?
Incredible. It's incredible.
And, you know, you mentioned that if it were not for Festival Mosaic, there would be no Now Hear This on PBS.
That is 100% true.
Talk about why that is.
Well, you know, I think it was like maybe 15 years ago now. It feels like yesterday, or it feels like last year, but it was really 15 years ago. We were trying to figure out where to take the festival. You know, Cliff had essentially built the pack. He had put the festival on the map. They were getting huge names to come here. You know, Edgar Meyer was coming here. Hilary Hahn was coming here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were at this point where we weren't sure whether to do more concerts in the pack, whether to slimmed down. We were a little bit directionless, I think, just for a little while. And the consultant that we hired, he asked us really tough questions, and one of them was, well, what do you want to do? And Curtis Pendleton, our then executive director, she said, I just want to be bigger and have more concerts and sell them out. And he kept asking, well, why? And he just kept asking why and questioning our assumptions. And he suggested, why don't you, instead of trying to be bigger in this small community, why don't you try to get deeper? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a fascinating concept, and I never thought of it that way, you know. And so we came up with this concept of having sort of a museum docent's guide to classical music. And by the way, we're not the inventors of it. It's been done before. But we decided to try to do it here in San Luis Obispo because there are plenty of people in this town who love the music that we play, but have the perception, I will say, that they don't quite understand it fully. And we felt like our job was to sort of help people get access to this kind of art music and give them different points of entry into the art form. So if they want to hear a concert, no talking, great, you can do that. If you want to go to a short concert at 12 o'clock, great, do that. But if you want maybe a little bit of a deeper dive into, let's say, a Tchaikovsky sextet, well, here it is. And so we tinkered around with that format for years, and we finally came up with something called Notable Encounters, which has ended up being a very sort of a pivotal, sort of a fulcrum of the music festival. We exported a Notable Encounter that we did here in San Luis Obispo to Austin, Texas, because one of my best friends, Bjorn Sang, the wonderful cellist, he teaches at the University of Texas, Austin. So we delivered a Notable Encounter that we did here in San Luis Obispo in Austin. And in the audience, there were only 8 people in the audience, but one of the people was Harry Lynch. He came up to me after the concert and he said, hey, I really liked that Notable Encounter that you did. I think we need to make a TV show. And I was just kind of shocked. You know, I thought maybe he was joking or just paying me a compliment. So I didn't really follow up. And a month later, he called and said, okay, do you remember me? It's Harry Lynch. You know, we met last month, and I was surprised to hear from him. And he said, I hope it's okay. I got your number from Bjorn. And we talked for the next 6 months. And then a year later, we were filming the pilot in Milan. And then 7-8 months later, we were meeting with PBS in Washington, D.C. And then I think it was a year and a half later, we were on the air.
Wow.
And that was it. But it all started here in San Luis Obispo. And people think I'm exaggerating. Oh, it all started here. No, it's actually, it was something that we developed for a program here. And we repeated it word for word in Austin. And that sparked something in a producer, which sparked a TV show. So I really am. And that obviously, the TV show also completely changed my life as much as this festival has. You know, I'm very grateful to the festival for providing the environment where something like that could flourish. It's not every community where that would flourish, but there are many very curious people in this community. Mm-hmm. There are people who listen to KCBX. There are people who watch public television. There are people who go to the art museum. They go to the music festival, they will go to hear something at Cal Poly Arts. They'll hear a symphony concert. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, they're very curious people.
It's a vibrant community. It's incredible for an area our size, how culturally rich it is here. Your first notable insight is coming up this Thursday, and it's a look into the Doknányi Sextet, and that is right before the first chamber concert, which is coming up on Friday. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the Doknányi and why it is worth spending an evening digging into it?
Absolutely. So a few years ago, we played the Doknányi Serenade, which is a piece for violin, viola, and cello, and the audience really, really liked it. And I said, would you like to hear some more Doknányi? And they responded with an enthusiastic yes. it's just Brahms with just more Hungarian flavor. I mean, it's fantastic music. The reason why the Dohnányi Sextet in particular is such fertile ground is that usually when composers write a first draft of something and then they write a second draft or a final draft, the first draft is thrown out. There are very few exceptions. And the thing is that there's so few, we all know what they are. The Sibelius Violin Concerto comes in two versions. Nobody plays the first one. The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto comes in two versions. Nobody plays the first one. The Brahms B major trio is probably the most famous. It comes in two versions. Almost nobody plays the first one. And the Schumann Fourth Symphony comes in two versions, and almost nobody plays the first one. Well, there are a few other pieces like that, but one of them is the Dohnányi Sextet. It was written as a student piece and then rewritten after he went to college. He used it as his entrance exam into the Hungarian National Conservatory. Mm. He was accepted. He really wanted the piece to be performed by some famous people at the Hungarian National Conservatory. But the only way for that to happen was for him to work on it or, quote, write it at the National Conservatory, and in his case, rewrite it. And that would give him at least a shot at getting performed by Yeno Hubai, who was a great violinist and a teacher there. And so when you look at a piece that a composer composed and then he or she rewrites it, then you've taken out the variable of it being somebody else writing it, right? And you're just looking at apples to apples, like, what did he write, how did he change it, and why? And so that's what we do. What we're going to do in this notable encounter is take a look at this piece of music that he wrote as a 16-year-old. He gets a ton of schooling, and now why does he rewrite it, and how does he rewrite it? For me, it's fascinating.
Talk about the feeling of the work. How does it feel and sound?
You know, it's interesting because it sounds like Brahms a little bit, with a little bit of Dvorak mixed in, and there's some Bach mixed in. It's really interesting because it is still a youthful work, so you feel like you're playing the music of a kid in a good way. I mean, he's a genius also. But you're also, as you scan his mind, you're starting to see a little bit of Brahms in there, a little bit of Mozart in there. You're starting to see the contemporary composers that Dohnányi was exposed to. And by contemporary, I mean Brahms. He was only dead 10 years. Dvorak was still alive. Rachmaninoff was still alive. Like, all of these people. Fauré was still alive. Debussy was still alive. Ravel was still alive. So, I mean, there is a little bit of that in the Dohnányi, which is just amazing to me that this is a 16-year-old writing this. It's scary.
Your chamber concerts, there are four of them,
mm-hmm.
and they have everything from Haydn and Mendelssohn and Dohnányi to contemporary composers.
Right.
How do you go about deciding what's going to go together in a concert and balancing through the whole festival between earlier works and romantic works on through contemporary composers?
So that's a very easy answer, which is that we try to balance and we try to lure the audience in with the more recognizable names like Haydn or Mozart. And then we try to throw something in that the audience doesn't know. I'm thinking specifically of the Adams Chamber Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
are throwing that in knowing that probably the audience has no idea what that is. They've never heard it. They've never heard of it. And hopefully, at the end of the concert, they will say, wow, I like the Adams the most. And it's not because we're trying to specifically sell Adams or American music or music of living composers. No, we're trying to sell the idea that art music is much bigger than just Ina Kleina Nock music. It's much bigger than that. And that if you keep an open mind, that you can have many meals of not just steak or fish or potatoes or salad, that you can have naan or you can have curry or you can have teppan grill or you can experience many, many more things in life, and your life can be richer from this music. And I think that's kind of our job to as a cultural institution to sort of expand people's brains and let them know that there's a lot more to enjoy than you know about. And hey, enjoy life even more. Here it is.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with Scott Yu, who's the music director of Festival Mosaic, which is happening in venues throughout San Luis Obispo County, starting this coming Wednesday, July 16th, and running through Saturday, the 26th. Scott, the festival actually really, really started last week because you have this new thing you're doing, the Young Artists mini concerts. Talk about these young artists and how you decided to move forward with this, where they come from, and are they part of the rest of the festival that's coming up?
That's a great question. This kind of goes in with the idea of being deeper and not wider. There is a world-class teaching festival about an hour and 20 minutes south of us in Santa Barbara that's going on now, the Music Academy of the West. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. They do a great job. The students that they have down there have an amazing time, a life-changing time. We don't need to do that. We don't have the bandwidth to do that in a small place like San Luis Obispo. What we do have the bandwidth to do is give a limited number of fellows a sort of life-changing experience that's very deep. And so what we decided to do was just this year start out with just a string quartet, and we would train them in Colorado at the Colorado College Summer Music Festival, where I've been teaching for a long time. I think I'm going on my 25th year next year. Mm. And we would take four people that we know their work, we know that they have great work ethic, they're wonderful people, you know, really people that we would be happy to spend time around. And we would really work them hard on any given string quartet. Then they'd have a couple of days off where they can catch their breath. And then they would come here where we would work with them intensively and then maybe add to that another piece of music. So this young string quartet played Beethoven's last string quartet, Opus 135. They played it, I think, four times. In that first week, they are sort of treated a little bit more like students, maybe. You know, we're giving them some coachings and really sort of holding their hand through the process. But now that it's the beginning of the week and people are starting up, people are coming in, they will be rank and file festival artists. We will treat them no better, no worse. They will be paid the same. They will eat the same food. They will play in the same groups. They will play in the orchestra. Everything will be the same. The only difference really is that they will be younger than everybody else in at the festival, but that's okay.
What are their age ranges?
Ethan Blake, the cellist, I think is 25, and Anne Marie Winneck, is 21. So they're, you know, they're young. Anne Marie will be the youngest person here. Mm-hmm. And I think what is cool, when I played my first professional chamber music festival, I was 21 years old also. I played the Seattle Chamber Music Festival. And, you know, I really had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to socialize with the other musicians. I just didn't understand the drill. And I think for these young artists, for them to have somebody sort of explain how it works in real time, I think it's going to be good for them as they move on and play in other professional chamber music festivals and other orchestral festivals, or better yet, start their own. I think we're the right place to do that. We're small, and everybody is very, very nurturing here. And I hope that the fellows, after next week, not this week, but after next week, they look back on this and say, wow, this was really pivotal for me. I really learned a lot about how to be a professional.
Another thing that you're doing that is deeper is film series with the SLO Film Center at the Palm Theater. There are films running during the festival, and you can get the schedule at the festival website, which is festivalmosaic.com. That's Mosaic, M-O-Z-A-I-C. And you can get information about all of the concerts and notable insights and everything that we're talking about today. You have an artist in residence every year, and this year it's Sophie Hsiao. Talk about her and talk about how she's going to be highlighted during the summer festival.
You know, Sophie is playing a recital during the festival. She's done a couple of concerts here in San Luis Obispo during the year. Sophie is an old friend of mine. She was a child prodigy cellist. I heard about her first when she was, I think, just 17 or 18 years old. She was already playing at the Marlboro Music Festival, and I thought, my God, she's so young. I think she was the youngest person at the festival at the time. You know, I just felt that Sophie had such a sort of interesting artistic portfolio as a cellist. I thought, you know, she would be really good to sort of bring her perspective on music to San Luis Obispo, and I think people have enjoyed her concerts very much. The nice thing about our artists in residence is that they kind of continue to be in residence. None of these artists in residence have just sort of up and left after their residency. You know, they've all kind of continued. So we've enjoyed having them. And next year, we already know who our next artist in residence is. I don't know. I just love it because each one of those people essentially becomes the artistic director of their own version of the festival, and the festival changes color, and you just hear things that you would never have heard if they were programmed by me, because I don't know about those things. Mm-hmm. But they do, and so I just love that.
I see that Sophie is doing a community midday concert, mm-hmm. which is free or
right.
a donation,
right?
Coming up on the 19th at the United Methodist Church on
with
Frederick
John.
Street.
Yeah.
And yeah, John Novacek.
Yes,
is
who was also a artist in residence.
Well, Sophie is going to be playing the Brahms Cello Sonata No. 2 in F coming up on the 19th. And also something by Kaija Saariaho.
Yes.
So, and Foray. So a broad range of contemporary works too.
That's kind of how Sophie is. She's a very broad musician, and she's very comfortable in kind of a wide space. Like she nothing really fazes her. She's kind of fearless.
Besides artists in residence, you have a lot of regulars who come and play in the chamber concerts and also in the orchestra. And you do these things like the midday concerts that are free, or Boatsart, which is brass music being played off of a pier in Baywood Park.
Right.
And that's something that I appreciate so much about Festival Mosaic, is that you make music, beautiful music, accessible to the community and to people of all different means.
If we charge nothing for every ticket, we wouldn't be able to do the festival, because just financially, we do need the revenue. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cover everything, but we do need the revenue. But if we did only ticketed paid events, there would be a sizable chunk of our audience that we would not interact with, and that's not acceptable. So I think the way we have it is a good mix of free and ticketed, and ticketed and paid. I think we're doing a good mix there.
Now, I had said earlier that you present primarily classical music, but you do these other types of concerts as well, and you have one regularly at the Sea Canyon Fruit Ranch.
Yeah.
And our Carlos Nakai is coming. That is so impressive to me that you are able to bring in the iconic Native American flute player.
Well, you know, I have to say, I think that Sea Canyon is such a seductive place to play. You know, it's sort of its own natural amphitheater, and it's always full. And I have seen Sea Canyon from the stage, and it is very invigorating to see that many people just staring at you. I mean, it's really kind of hypnotizing. And I think that we've been able to get some really excellent acts to come and perform at Sea Canyon because they kind of know about the venue, and they know that, you know, they're going to be treated well there. If I were an audience member, I think that's probably the first ticket I would buy, is Sea Canyon. That's why it sells out really fast, because you know, everybody likes that venue, but it's really cool.
I have a feeling that there's going to be a rapt audience this coming July 20th. Our Carlos Nakai is playing with percussionist Will Klipman, and Lloyd Tanner told me that some Shumash are going to come and do a welcome.
Wow.
And it just feels like the perfect place to have Native American flute. I think it's going to be just peaceful, almost a spiritual experience. And you always have your Baroque in the Vines, which sold out already.
Yeah.
There are venues all over San Luis Obispo County. Another thing that's sort of off the beaten track that you're doing this year is at the Fremont Theater. Mm-hmm. And later in this hour, during Issues and Ideas, we're talking to the founder of Orquesta Acocan, who is going to be playing at the Fremont Theater on July 24th.
Yeah, that's going to be a great show.
Are you going to be there and be dancing?
I think I'm going to be there, actually. I think we have a babysitter lined up for that.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with Scott Yu, who's the music director of Festival Mosaic, which is running July 16th through the 26th at venues throughout San Luis Obispo County. And as I mentioned, it presents primarily classical music, but Orquesta Acocan, who we just mentioned, is a Cuban group, a mambo, and we've got our Carlos Nakai and so much more, including the film series. The big closing concert, July 26th at the Performing Arts Center in San Luis Obispo, you're featuring Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. Alice, your wife, is playing Nielsen's Flute Concerto, mm-hmm. and then you're doing the Leonor Overture, No. 3 by Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the Prokofiev, the Romeo and Juliet suite.
You know, I was thinking about how many composers have set Romeo and Juliet or some variation of that story. Berlioz set Romeo and Juliet to music. Tchaikovsky set Romeo and Juliet to music. But I must say that Prokofiev, I mean, he was almost born to set, like, his language was written for that story. His language is, it's so descriptive, so visual. I don't know. I was just studying the score this morning, and it's hard to understand how, like, one person could have come up with all of that. I mean, where did that come from? I don't know. That sort of era in classical music around the turn of the century where you had people like Ravel and Prokofiev hang out with each other, with Picasso, Dali, Diaghilev, Michel Fokine, like all of these incredible intellects that are essentially, you know, sitting having coffee in Paris. I just felt that it would be such a wonderful way to end the season, because the orchestra that we field at this festival is so sort of absurdly strong. It would kind of feature everybody, and it would show off every section of the orchestra, which is just, there's just not a weak section in the orchestra. The Leonore Overture No. 3 . The reason we're doing that is very simple. We wanted to feature something from the last concert of 2005, which was the closing concert of my first year as the director of the then San Luis Obispo Mozart Festival. Mm-hmm. The Nielsen Concerto, I've been fortunate to do with my wife, I think, four times in the last couple of years. We've just done it a lot together, and she's just gotten better and better and better at it, and she plays it at a world-class level, and I just felt like, you know, that would be a really fun thing to do. The audience likes Alice, and the orchestra likes Alice, and it would just be kind of a very upbeat way to sort of end the first half. So that became the program. It just kind of came together in a very natural way, and I know I'm really looking forward to it.
That sounds like a really great way to end your 20th year celebration with Festival Mosaic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were walking off stage after one of the rehearsals, and one of the musicians, who's the principal of a major orchestra, he sort of muttered under his breath, "Wow, this orchestra is stupid good." And it is stupid good. I mean, it really behaves like no other orchestra that I've ever stood in front of. I mean, it just, people do this festival just because they love playing music. And so there's a certain type of energy and freshness that comes out of it that is really hard to replicate. It's really only possible at a festival. It's not possible in a full-time job. It's not sustainable.
And speaking of sustainability, you had mentioned that you need to sell tickets, but ticket sales don't cover the cost of everything.
Right.
So you rely very heavily on donations.
Right.
And grants too, I'm assuming.
Right. Some grants, a lot of donations, and then ticket revenue. So we have to make sure that each spoke of the wheel is sturdy, that our contributed revenue is reliable, that our ticket sales are robust, and that we are getting support from local businesses and from foundations that give grants.
And if you are so moved, you can donate to Festival Mosaic at festivalmosaic.com. And that's also where you can find the full summer festival schedule, and you can get tickets there, and anything that you want to know about Festival Mosaic, it's at festivalmosaic.com. Thank you so much for joining me and having a chat, Scott Yu.
It's an honor, Marisa, every time.
You've been listening to Scott Yu, the music director of Festival Mosaic, which runs at venues throughout San Luis Obispo County, July 16th through the 26th. I'm Marisa Waddell.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Samantha Doyle Jacobson, sitting in for Meher Ali. Today we're taking a deep dive into Festival Mosaic. Up next, we'll explore the music and background of a Cuban mambo group Festival Mosaic is bringing to San Luis Obispo.
My name is David Figueroa, and at KCBX, I host late-night music radio shows, particularly Latin music shows. Trotamundos, which is all about eclectic Latin music, and then Ritmo y Sabor, which is a little bit more upbeat, and it's on Friday nights, and we try to help people get into their weekends in style. And joining us on this piece is Lloyd Tanner. He's the executive producer of Festival Mosaic. Lloyd has several decades of service planning, marketing, and organizing music events. And I felt most importantly when I was reading a little bit about him is that he's a trombone player. I used to play trombone, but I still have that instrument very close to my heart and also close to my fingers when I'm choosing music to play. Lloyd, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we also have Jacob Plas, who is part of Orquesta Acucan. I will say a few words about Jacob, but hopefully he can fill us in on a lot more. He's a musician, producer, a prolific Latin music artist, and he has projects such as Orquesta Acucan, but also Los Sacheros, which I think you have led and put together.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as far as production goes, you've dealt with groups who we've seen on the Central Coast, such as Flor de Toroache. And
yeah.
I also drew attention to an artist I only found out a few months ago, Maria Raquel. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
And I guess, Jacob, can you just say, before we get into Orquesta Acucan, just a little bit more about yourself and maybe some projects you're currently involved in?
Sure. I've been working in Latin music for a long time, as you well know. My first group was this group Los Acheros, which is sort of New York-style salsa, charanga thing, a mix of, it was a group everyone's based in New York, and out of that group in relationships, I started this group called Orquesta Acucan, which is a mambo group, which is 12 Cuban musicians and me and Mike Eckroth, who's the arranger. We have three albums out now. We're actually working on the fourth one. And we're really excited to be playing at the Festival Mosaic coming up. I think it's going to be a great gig for us.
Yeah, I am fascinated for a lot of reasons that Orquesta Acucan has found its way to San Luis Obispo. Some listeners might remember that in 2019, Orquesta Acucan appeared at Live Oak, which is, of course, a big annual musical happening in our area. And I got to ask, because I can't remember if I saw you on stage, but were you part of that concert back?
Yes.
In the pre-COVID world?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I'm at all the shows.
Okay.
I play the trace, which is a Cuban guitar. Trace, uno, dos, trace. Instead of it being a standard guitar, there are six strings paired together, and it has you play in a very percussive way to sort of help the rhythm along. It's like what a piano does, like Eddie Palmieri. Somebody like that in a salsa band, the trace does. And actually, what piano players play in salsa bands is originally based on the trace. So it's rare to have it in a mambo band, but because it's my mambo band, I put it in it.
Tell us a little bit about the origin story of Orquesta Acucan, not just that first album, because I do have a question about that, but how you got to that first album, how you got the band together.
Yeah, it's a good question. Me and Mike Eckroth have been making music in a bunch of different forms for a long time. We had a project called Milaz and Peli Roja, and then Mike was really into Benny Moré, and I wasn't quite as into it. For whatever reason, I was in this guy's band and he loved Benny Moré and he was like a real jerk. So out of some sort of rebellion, I didn't listen to Benny Moré. But once I started, I was totally hooked. And then we got introduced to Cesar Lopez, who's a fantastic Cuban saxophone player. He lives there still. He was in Ira Carey. He has his own group. He's our man in Havana. So we created, we got kind of hooked up with him, and he put together this band of unbelievable musicians. Like, me and Mike didn't even realize until after how unbelievable they were, like who they were in Cuban music. I mean, we knew the name anyway. And so we went down there and recorded this album, and we're just like, wow, this is really cool. But, you know, whatever. Great. We'll give this to the Daptone, and they'll put it out, and that will be that. But people really loved it, and it somehow struck a nerve in the public, and it became a real band. And after that album, we've been, you know, touring the world ever since. Yeah, so it's kind of a dream come true. Like, I mean, as you can imagine, running a Cuban mambo band with all the politics and what, even any band, even a 4-piece band is hard to run. But if you have a 12-piece band and you're bringing people from all over, you know, all over, it's quite challenging. So, but it's you know, when the band plays on live, there's like nothing else in the world like it. For me, at least, you know.
I was thinking that inspiration to call the band Acocan, that seems to come a lot from the Afro roots, in fact, the Afro spiritual roots in Cuba.
Yeah.
Who kicked that one off, and how did it catch on as being the name of the band?
Oh, I think a lot of the thought behind this is that we wanted to present mambo as a thing that was like a very rich cultural and spiritual thing. I think sometimes in the past, you know, it's like mambo has sort of been this, what, like a novelty thing, you know, like you imagine Desi Arnaz or whatever. But for us, it's like the deepest thing there is, you know. It's like Louis Armstrong. It's like, you know, it's Miles Davis. It's Duke Ellington. And it, like, from a artistic and intellectual point of view, and the difficulty of the music is, and the exactingness of what it takes to do this right. We wanted to acknowledge that in the name. And so to acknowledge the Africanness of it, and also just from the heart that it's not some trivial thing. So just to acknowledge that it's an orchestra and this big group, and that we're trying to keep alive or bring back this idea of musicianship and dedication.
There you go. Well, we think it sounds good.
Thank you. Thanks.
And I guess one thing I'm also drawn to is the title, Contemporary Cuban Mambo. And I'm just wanting you to describe that a little bit for our audience who might think they know a bit about mambo. But what's your take on contemporary Cuban mambo?
Sure. I get lost in these terms myself. I guess it's sort of funny because I try not to be contemporary. I like the older style of mambo. My goal is to try to be like Benny Murray and Perez Prado and Tito Puente. But you fail, so I guess that makes it contemporary. But I love those old recordings. I don't think anyone's gonna ever do it better, but we try, and you know, all our music is original, but we look up at those people as like our gods or whatever, you know. We don't take that much. I wouldn't say it's not like we don't take any inspiration from contemporary music. That wouldn't be fair. But, you know, I actually read this Joshua Redman quote at one point where he was like talking about, like, yeah, it's kind of easy to sound like somebody taking a solo like on a Michael Jackson tune. It's hard to sound like Lester Young. So I guess maybe something like that would apply to how we think about things. It's like those artists are our lodestar for musical excellence.
Yeah, I have to agree with you that those are fantastic models to try to follow.
Yeah.
And so if you can even get close, then you're doing a great job. And I remember being drawn and understanding early, probably just because of some of the marketing of the self-titled first album, that it was recorded in these old studios in Havana, the Estudios Areto. And was that suggested by some of your collaborators, or did you know about that studio at the time? Let's say, because the sound is just really incredible.
I am a lucky so-and-so, because I didn't know. I walked into this room and I was like, what is it? It's like the size of it's in a nondescript building in central Havana. Like there's no way you wouldn't know from the outside. It's like a speakeasy almost. And then you go in and it's like this giant cavern. It's almost like a gymnasium, but the greatest sounding gymnasium you've ever been in. And you walk in, you immediately feel like you're in a sacred space. And then, you know, I looked at the records on the walls, you know, Nat King Cole, early O'Mara, I think some of the Buena Vista stuff was recorded there. And yeah, I feel so lucky, because now that space doesn't even exist anymore. So,
wow.
It was, yeah. And I feel like, Paul Simon, I read one time, like, talks about how, like, the studio, the room is like another musician in the band. And that was definitely true for that recording, because the room was so special. I think we mainly, not to get too nerdy, but, you know, normally you like mic, especially these days, you mic everybody, you put a mic on every instrument, and then, you know, drums, you put lots of mics on. I think on that recording, it was basically like one mic in the room, maybe like a couple things to balance. But I think that's part of the sound of that, is that room and the, you know, and the great players, obviously.
Yeah, I know there's a kind
of... That was a really special one.
Yeah, there's a kind of reverberation on just the general sound that is throughout the album, and it's just really incredible. It does sound like it was recorded live, which indeed it was, but not in front of the crowd, but in that studio.
That's part of our thing, too, is that, like, those older albums that I love, like, part of the reason they sound amazing is that they're recorded live. And when that happens, there's, you know, people make mistakes and there's mistakes in the recording, but what you get is the sound of people interacting and breathing together. And when you don't have that with this type of music, to me, it always falls. It'll never be as good as those recordings, because there's something about a band playing live. That's why I like music, is to hear great musicians interacting, you know? So I think we're lucky. Luckily, we had that on that. On all of the records, we have that. But that record in particular was made in a very special place, especially because it doesn't exist anymore.
I had a couple of things. I know that not just Akokan, but some of your other projects, you use a technique you're calling live to analog tape.
Yeah.
And to some of our younger listeners, that could sound like science fiction. but I'm just curious if you can just talk a little bit about why you're drawn to that and what you get out of the experience versus more digital methods that are predominant today.
Sure. I think, the thing is, the kind of the proof is in the pudding. Like, once you do it, it's hard to go back to just doing things digitally. Like, there's a richness. I think, you know, people get obsessed with the idea of tape. And yes, it's the tape, but it's like the whole process, the idea of getting musicians together in a room to play together. We're not going to overdub things. We're not going to play things to a click. We can't fix things. Like, the notes you play matter. I think it's all the psychological stuff that goes into the, also, we're going to record this using gear, as much as gear as we can from the 60s and from that time period when this music was made. So I think there's like the technical component that adds, like, of using tape and old preamps and compressors, that adds a warmth. But then there's also a performance aspect that's just as, you know, implied in that analog way of recording, where it's like, we're going to record people live. Like I said, we're not going to use a click track. We're not going to fix things. We're going to be true to what happened in the room and the way people were the way people felt that day, and you know, all these things that make us love a live recording, because it's like a snapshot of time, you know, that doesn't, is not as, for whatever reason, doesn't happen as much these days.
Yeah, I agree. There's a magic in that moment, and that's, you can't really replace that just mixing things together through different digital feeds. Or let's say it's very, very challenging to do that.
Right. So I think, you know, like, yeah, this, we like to imagine that like having options makes things better, but I think in recorded music, that's debatable, whether being able to do overdub a thing 100 times, you're going to get something that was truer than what you did when you were inspired, you know?
And like this most recent album, Caracoles, is that recorded in Cuba or is that a project?
Yes.
Recorded?
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, that's recorded in Abdala, which is also an amazing giant room. Silvio Rodriguez, the singer, songwriter, Nueva Trova artist, he built that, and yeah, the room sounds incredible too. It's just different.
Con licencia, mi sangre, cuenta cheche. Con licencia, lucero, en pembacariré.
Yeah, it's a great sound, and it's a great new album. We've been listening to it here, of course, and even
our
morning music show, The Morning Cup, they had some songs off
the
album this morning.
Awesome.
So
it's amazing.
It's a favorite of KCBX. And I'm hoping that sound will like being in the Fremont Theater. I don't know if you've seen it or heard of it. It's one of the old style cinemas in. It's got a proper stage as well, so stage performances can go in there. A big Cuban band probably will do very well in that space.
Yeah, for sure.
And I guess, Lloyd, I'm just curious if you had choices to make when you knew you were getting Orquesta Acocan and where they might fit best.
Well, I mean, the first thing that we did when we realized that we had an opportunity to have them at the Fremont was I wanted to take away all the removable seats in the front and make that general mission, let everybody dance, you know, have a good time, and make it more of a show than just going to a performing arts hall and sitting down. I not that I'm the best dancer in the world, but you know, just sitting there with all of that energy that's coming from the stage from, you know, 12 plus musicians is infectious. So I think it's going to be great. It's Art Deco design, so it sort of feels of the time as well.
Oh, cool.
And we're right in downtown. It'll be farmers market night, so there'll be a lot of great energy. We're gonna have a Cuban food truck out front. So we're really leaning into it.
I love hearing all of that. Well, all good. I have a couple more questions here. You were working on a new project. I thought that Caracoles was a great new project, but you've got even more to tell us about?
Oh, well, you know, the thing is, yes, we were working on a new album, but, and it's, I'm so excited about it. But, you know, it takes us a long time from recording to release, so it probably won't come out for another year. But, yeah, it's I wouldn't say it's more of the same, but it's the band live. And this time we did it at the Daptone Studios in Riverside, which has another really great sounding room. But yeah, we're just like in the final stages of arranging that. So it's exciting. You know, I think for me, you know, people have different, I think there are musicians who love touring. There are musicians who love playing live. I tend to be somebody who loves being in the studio and being a nerd. I mean, I love being with Acocan, but for me, like the create, like thinking about the record and how the songs flow together, and just recording live has always been like where I feel most at home or most satisfied. You know,
nice.
Well, lucky for me, like the rest of the Cubans, they live for playing live, so it's balanced out.
So, how many in the band are based in Cuba?
That's a good question. Right now, you know, a lot of people are living here because of a lot of musicians have left. But, you know, people are back and forth to the extent they can be. It's sort of a delicate question because I don't really know exactly where. I do know they will all be at the show.
That's so important.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I was just curious in after that if they perform or if Ako Khan performs much in Cuba or if that's not really happening.
You know, we go there mainly to record and work on music, and then mainly we tour outside of it just because the way the currency is and everything, it's hard to fly a band that big in with what they're able to provide financially.
Exactly.
It's expensive having a mambo band.
Suave, suave, suave. Mambita para ti. Sabroso. El mambo suave se baila bien relajado, sin mucho apuro pa' que quede descansado. Pero no te preocupes que es cadencioso, tiene su maña y no te engaña el paso que tiene. Sé que te va a gustar para guarachar.
It's such a pleasure. I'm just going to ask you to speak with our listeners who might be thinking, wow, I've never thought about going to a mambo performance, but this sounds pretty interesting. What's the last little piece of marketing you can give them to get them to get there on July 24th?
I don't know. This music changed my life. I don't know if it will change your life, but it might. So that's enough. It's made everything better for me. And it's the music, it's the warmth, it's all the things that we hope when we go to experience art.
Yeah,
and so I think in this, you know, we all can play on our phones all day and there's some cool stuff on there, but what we want to do is to experience, like, I mean, for me, what I want to do is experience a great band live with other people who are also into it. Yeah, mambo change your life. That's it.
I love it. Yeah, listeners of Issues and Ideas, take the opportunity to change your life. Go see Orquesta Ako Khan at the Fremont Theater on July 24th. Lloyd, anything to add there about the show or the festival?
Just really excited to have these wonderful musicians come to San Luis Obispo. I think our audience is going to have an experience like no other. And we look forward to seeing everybody the 16th through the 26th of July at Festival Mosaic San Luis Obispo Music Festival.
To Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed the theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Samantha Doa Jacobson. Join each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.